you must generate a style that's recognizable. So someone can say, hey, that's a Lovegrove shot, or that's a Matt Brandon shot. And it's hard to have a definable style and yet not have this sense of repetition.
From thedigitaltrekker.com, I'm Matt Brandon, and this is Depth of Field, the podcast about working photographers. I'm speaking today with Damien Lovegrove. I have been wanting to talk to Damien for some time for two reasons. One, he's an expert in lighting, and this is something that has been a real challenge for me in my work. And then also, he's an ex-photographer, which is always nice to hang out with other ex-photographers. He's also worked for the BBC, and I think that's just a really interesting area that I wanted to touch on with him as well. So, Damien, welcome to the Depth of Field.
Thank you very much, Matt. It's a pleasure to be here. It'll be quite nice to spend some time chatting to you and discussing the types of things that your audience would love to hear.
The show is, as I mentioned to you prior to recording, is really about the working photographer. I chose not to use the word professional because there's so much baggage with that, as you know.
But
people that are out there working, they're trying to make an income off their photography and things like that. And I want to jump into that. But before I do that, I want to give our listeners a little background on you. Of course, there are so many interviews with you out there, both on video as well as podcasts and written interviews, that it's not hard to find information about your past and your history. But briefly, one of the things that seems to come up all the time is your work with the BBC. How did that come about, and what was it specifically that you did with the BBC? Was it work in stills, or was it work just with in crafting the light, or did you work in the video? What did you do?
Well, it's funny you should ask this, because obviously, because the BBC has got such gravity about it, you know, it's an institution that's well known worldwide. It was 20 years ago that I left the BBC. And so I joined the BBC back in 1984 as a trainee cameraman. And after 3 years, I went through
when you say cameraman. Excuse me. When you say
video
cameraman,
camera, video, so okay. Video camera. At those days, you didn't have cameras you could put on your shoulder. These things were great big blocks, you know, sort of half a hundredweight, or I suppose it's 50 kilos or so. You know, those are big, big machines. I went through that process. I was there 14 years with the BBC, and I was very, you know, it was a lovely experience to have. So I went because I was a cameraman. It took 3 years to train to become a cameraman, and then another 3 years to train in sort of rudimentary lighting to become a lighting cameraman, and then another 2 years or so there to become a lighting director. And then I got made redundant, got a quick job in news for 3 or 4 years, and I left the BBC in 1998. Now, when I left the BBC, the wedding industry was relatively poor. I mean, most of the people earning money from shooting weddings at that time were, you know, working on the weekends. Perhaps by day they were an engineer or a delivery man or a postman or what have you. And on the weekend they took their Hasselblad out and they shot weddings. And some people used to shoot 3 or 4 weddings a day, you know, 4 rolls of 120, pop it through the film and it through the camera and off you go. And of course, that process was quite a common process. You know, people were shooting weddings and shooting social photography at the time. Majority of those people had second incomes. You know, photography was their hobby, and they earned a little bit of money from the photography to pay for their hobby, because obviously equipment was expensive, film and processing was expensive. And I saw wedding photography as an opportunity for me, because I could use the skills that I'd learned at the BBC, the narrative, telling a story, creating a body of work which is eloquent, self-supporting, and putting an album together with maybe 150 pictures, which just work together. It is a beautiful record of a wedding day. I wanted to work with a specific style. So really, we're looking back, I suppose, between 1998 and 2000, I developed that style. And I used My work with the BBC in order to do that. So, for instance, when I shot, we used to shoot drama, and I'm sure it's the same all over the world. You know, you can look at American dramas see exactly the same strategies, where every shot is taken at the same aperture. Every tracking shot, if it's a positive scene, the tracking shot is from left to right. If it's a negative scene, it's right to left. The camera is always below the eye line, looking up at the person. The lighting is always a backlight and a key light, little kick light. And so the style remains the same. And I looked at the wedding photography in the UK. I was surprised because some pictures were taken at f11 with on-camera flash. Some pictures were taken wide open at 1600 ISO, and the bride and groom perhaps coming down the aisle. And the shots of the bride and groom, the stage portraits, had a very different feel and look to the ones of the bride and groom cutting the cake or, you know, other ceremonial parts. So it was a bit of a dog's dinner, the standard procedure. So I decided to put a bit of continuity and style in. And so for 10 years, I worked with my wife and we created wedding albums, which were all shot at F4. Every single picture I took for 10 years was F4. Every picture was shot either with a wide lens or a tight lens, nothing on a standard lens. So I had a wide lens to set the scene. So we would be with the groom in the room when they're all the guys were getting ready. And I just have a nice big wide shot to show the ushers and the groomsmen having fun. And then I'd go in for the close-ups with the tight lens for the cufflinks, the rings, the groom's speech, individual headshots of people.
But still at F4.
All at F4. So you have this on, as you turn through the album, you'd have one spread, which would be a wide shot of the guys, and then close up, close up, close up. You turn the page, and now you're with the girls. And my wife, Julie, was photographing with the bride while I was with the groom. Mm-hmm. And there'd be a nice wide shot that established the scene where the girls are all getting ready, and then close up, close up, close up. Hair, makeup, shoes, detail of the back of the dress, etc. Right. Then you turn the page, you're back with the guys. So each time you turn the page, it's a new chapter. Sometimes, you know, you've got two stories working side by side. So in a TV drama, we might have a scene in one area with the baddies in the warehouse preparing all the guns and ammunition, and then we cut to the scene with the cops and all the good guys, you know, they're working out where the bad guys are, and then you cut back to what the bad guys are doing, then you cut back to what the good guys are doing, and you run these parallel stories and you intercut it, and that's what we did with the wedding albums. Now, of course, this whole concept hadn't been conceived before, and so it was something that was novel and new, and it didn't take long for Julie and I to really win over the hearts of the client base and become, you know, very well known. These are the days before Facebook and things like that, of course, mm-hmm. back in 2000 2001. But some lady called Martha Stewart got to see one of our wedding albums and said, "Oh my God, this is the best album ever," you know? And so suddenly we were inundated with these brides coming from Philadelphia, getting married in Venice, having their dress designer from New York and their makeup artist from Paris and their photographer from Bristol, you know, UK. So we were fulfilling that type of client base. And of course, over the period of 2002 to 2012, Julie and I shot about 400 weddings, and we basically paid the mortgage. You know, this was that period of 10 years head down, working flat out for our clients without lifting our heads. You know, we didn't have summer holidays. We just worked all the way through the summer. We had staff working for us, doing the picture editing, doing the administration, organizing the printing, gluing and sticking albums, and we just got a head down and service the clients. There's a certain amount of work you need to do as a photographer to earn an income, you know, and earn an income not just for the season, but for life. You know, at some point you've got to pay for your care or your health or your food or your housing or bills, not just up to the time you retire, but from the time you retire right through to however long you're going to live, be it 100 or 90 or whatever. And there's a certain number of, if you're shooting weddings and you're making maybe $1,000 profit a wedding, mm-hmm. You've got to work out, how many weddings do I need to shoot? You know, are 400 weddings enough? Are 600 weddings enough? You know, so very few people create that big picture equation in their mind as to how they can get off the treadmill.
You know, I think for many photographers, they're not thinking that far in advance. I mean, they literally think from either shoot to shoot or how much money do I have? Can I buy a new camera with it or things like that? I mean, do you have sort of this equation worked out to where you can actually share it with people, or how does that
work?
Yeah,
it's an interesting thing. No, it's not a sort of, you have to sort of understand what you want out of life. I mean, I think the first thing to understand is that photography, to earn a good living out of photography, you need to be passionate about it. I think if you really love what you do and you love your photography, then people will want a slice of that. That's the first thing. Now, to earn enough money to supplement another income is great, and it allows you to fulfill your passion, your dreams, etc. But when you convert or dedicate all of your working time to photography, then of course you sometimes you don't get the chance to pick and choose your customers. Mm-hmm. And photography, it becomes a job less of a passion. You know, it's really easy to lose the love for the project, you know. Mm-hmm. if you're putting this, so you've got to get that balance right. And I think the emotional balance is, the emotional equation is far more important in a way than the financial equation, because you know, you have to consider what your needs are emotionally, and how are you just going to earn enough money from photography to pay the bills, or are you going to earn enough money to sustain your life for the rest of your life? I mean, it's in the last 20, 25 years, I've seen very few people just go out, shoot, and have a really good income with just photography, as their only source of income.
Yeah, especially in the last 16 years that digital photography has come out, and cameras have literally gotten in everyone's hand and have become ubiquitous. I mean, they say that this is the most photographed generation, or the most, what's the word? My mind's blank all of
recorded.
A sudden. Yes, it's the most recorded generation of all times. And, there's this democratization of that we've talked about on this show before of photography, which everyone's a photographer, which I'm glad, that's great. I'm happy with that.
Absolutely.
But I'm not one of these guys that sits there and goes, well, not everybody's a photographer. Look at their work. I mean, that will sort of filter itself out, you know.
Have to provide a value. I mean, this is the key thing. And it's what's happened is, I mean, if we look at the whole business with the digital photography coming on board, you know, mm-hmm. the first 5 years, photography dipped in the public use of photography. People weren't shooting so much film anymore, but they couldn't really afford digital. But by the time we got to 2005, 2006, digital cameras were suddenly becoming affordable and mm-hmm. good enough to actually be worthwhile for hobbyists and other people. And so, and it was, but you know, within, by 2010, digital photography was, everybody had a camera, everybody had the opportunity to go out and shoot, and that was fantastic. But of course, photographers in the past shooting film, you know, often had they had these medium format cameras and light meters, and what they provided was a step above what the amateur could shoot themselves. Therefore, they had something they could sell. And it's always this differential between how good an amateur or someone who's prepared to do the work for free, or a friend, a relative of a bride, for instance, and what they can achieve and what a photographer who wants to charge for their work can achieve. And obviously that differential has to maintain. And this is why, I mean, when we opened this discussion, I was talking about the way we developed a product, which was different, you know, working mm-hmm. everything at F4, particular continuity of style. If you produce beautiful wedding albums with lovely, embossed leather, with the name of the bride and groom, with handmade prints, with bevel cut mounts, and you put them in beautiful boxes and you give a great experience, you can charge lots of money for that. But it takes a lot of effort to develop the products and the environment in order to sell those products. You know, there's still a lot of money in wedding photography, in weddings per se, whether it's with Jimmy Choo shoes, Vera Wang dresses, etc. There's an awful lot of money around at the moment. You know, Bentley can't make cars fast enough. You know, we've really got a global market where really people are just spending and spending and spending. And this is something which we need to consider as photographers. You know, you can't blame a fall in the amount of money being spent on things and everybody wants something for nothing, because actually the consumerism that we are surrounded by is immense. So really you've got to make see where the value lies, and the value has to be put in as from a photographer in the work you do has to be truly valued. It has to be different. And to be fair, most couples are quite happy with a reasonable record of their day. You know, a lot of the people that are getting married today, they've never commissioned a professional photographer before. So why should they on their wedding day? You know, it's just, it's only because their parents might have done and grandparents, etc. But you and I know, of course, the value of photography and recording it and printing it and keeping it for the next generation. Because obviously the first 5 or 6 years of digital photography from 2005 to 2010, the first years where the public were recording, you know, a lot of those pictures are lost now because they were JPEGs on computers that have gone or hard drives failed and people don't print stuff, as we know. And I feel that we've got to both educate the customer, but also provide really lovely products that people want to buy. You know, everybody else, all the other suppliers at a wedding, from the florists to the stationery designers to the wedding dress designers, they're all providing a service and beautiful aesthetic products. And I think that what's happened is the photographers have thought, oh, let's just put pictures on a disc or on a USB drive, rock up at a wedding, shoot, whiz them through Lightroom, off you go. That's not how weddings work. And I think that's a big mistake that I see a lot of people making at the moment.
Are you still doing weddings? I mean,
I've stopped doing weddings. We did 3 last year. I mean, I just do weddings for the people that I want to photograph the wedding. You know, what happened was I did 3 years of commercial photography when I left the BBC. Mm-hmm. Then we did 10 years of wedding photography. And that was that period of time, you know, that you just get your head down and earn the money. Mm-hmm. Then I did some portrait photography, which was basically all my wedding clients, the 400 clients, they all had babies and children. I'd already spent between $5,000 and $15,000 on wedding photography. And so they had money, they had the Ferraris, they had the gear, and they wanted us to photograph their children and their families and stuff. So there's an inherent amount of customer base that comes from, you know, working with bride and groom. So that was quite handy for us. I wanted to get out of that whole process of shooting weddings and things. And I spoke to my business consultant. He said, you know what you need? The exit strategy you need is to transfer that knowledge and experience and wisdom to the next generation of photographers. And he said, the first thing you're going to do is write a book. I thought, oh, really? I hadn't written anything since I left school, you know. I mean, it really...
That's why you're a photographer, right?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Of course. I'd written a few expenses forms at the BBC. But, so anyway, I had to learn to write. You know, I was reading Mark Twain and Hemingway and things, looking at writing styles and trying to really suss this thing out, you know. But anyway, I wrote this book.
Wait. Seriously, you went through like these classic novels just because you were going to write a book on photography?
Well, I didn't go through the novels. I looked at the styling of, yeah, I wrote, exactly. I mean, I didn't know my difference from first person, second person, third. I knew what third person was and first person. Ooh, what's second person? Mm-hmm. How does that work? I mean, do I say to someone, you know, when I'm writing my book, do I say you do this and then you do that and then you do this? Or do I say, now I did this and then I did that and now I do this? You know, do I instruct? Do I inform? Do I educate? How do I write? You know, I mean, so anyway, I went through that process and I wrote a 40,000 word book on weddings, which got published by Focal Press, an American company. And we sold 30,000 copies. You know, it was just flew off the shelves. And it was because I wrote it in conversational English, just like we're chatting now. Mm-hmm. And the people reading the book could feel that I was there in the room with them when they were reading that book. And that really made a difference. And so that was back in, I suppose, 2006, 2007.
Is that book still available?
I think it is, yeah. If you go on Amazon and look for Damien Lovegrove, it's called The Complete Guide to Professional Wedding Photography. Bear in mind, it was there are a couple of chapters which are a little bit out of date. So, for instance, post-production, I think I talk about, I think it's Life Before Lightroom. You know, I mean, I think I'm using Capture One at the time or something like that. But hey, you know, but generally speaking, everything in the book is still valid. You know, it's you see, you're photographing weddings. You're not in the service industry. You're in the retail industry. And you have to understand that retail has a very different set of rules to excite and entice people to spend money. And it's like the perfumes of the packaging, the whole, everything around the perfume as well adds to the value of what's in the bottle. As we all know. And of course, it's exactly the same with wedding photography.
Let me interject.
Yeah, of course.
I love what you just said there, because I don't know if I've ever heard any photographer say that you're not in the service industry, you're in the retail industry. Do you think that's the case through all across photography? In the sense of the professional work?
I mean, photography covers so many aspects. You can be a forensic photographer. You can be a documentary photographer, someone who work for a newspaper. You could have corporate clients. You can have all sorts. I think, you know, if you're
working... But you still have to market yourself. You still have to find that. You still have to think of yourself almost as retailing you as the product.
Sometimes. I think if you're certainly on commercial work, yeah, absolutely. But if you are a wildlife photographer and you spend your life just on your own in out in polar regions or wherever, and you're happy to sit in a bird hide for 3 weeks to get the shot, you know, your agency, your stock library does your marketing for you. You don't have to get involved with that. All you've got to do is keep submitting. It's the same with people who shoot stock for travel and things like that. They just keep submitting files into the libraries. And
that's dying. I mean, the whole stock thing is really, really depressed, from what I understand.
I earn a good chunk of money from stock. Yeah. I started shooting stock in 1986 for the Science Photo Library in London. And every holiday I've ever had in my life has been paid from income from stock. And to be quite honest, a lot of the money we're getting still now, I mean, I'm selling pictures now. I shot 20 years ago. We're still selling and they're doing really well. But I concentrated in my stock environment. I concentrated on pictures that were people wouldn't want to shoot. So the competition is poor, like babies being injected with MMR vaccines or pictures of IUDs or contraception or stress in the workplace, stress in the home, parents and children, arguments and all these things. And they're really relevant and they carry through now. And every quarter we still get great income from our stock library. So, and the Science Photo Library in London is big building, lots of staff. It's still absolutely vibrant. And so, you know, it's important to choose your right subjects for stock. But you see, I had this expensive hobby when I was at the BBC, and it was called photography. And I wanted the cameras and lenses. And every camera and lens I had, I wanted, you know, I had to buy it from my income from stock. So once I'd got a camera, if I didn't have a job that day or I was on a day off, I'd use that camera to generate pictures, submit them to the stock library, and that would earn money. And then I could buy the lens that I wanted to go, you know, et cetera. And it's worked that way ever since. You know, it's been a really, really good income. I know perhaps the golden days of stock are past for some genres, like the main key genres. But I think there's still a lot of money to be made if you're creative. So, for instance, take something like, think of time passing as a subject and then go out and shoot that. And shoot it on a, you know, you need a minimum of 22 million pixels, I'm afraid. That's because that's what it takes to make a double page spread at 300 dpi. And go and shoot water under the bridge or sand falling through an hourglass or people getting young to old. You know, think about how you can illustrate time passing. Get those images into a really good library and you watch those sell. They'll be used for pension brochures. They'll be used for annual reports or from big major companies looking at their customer base and how the customer base is changing. You know, things like that. You know, I photographed the electronic circuit board. I put a light from underneath it, and it had all these little ICs on it. And I photographed it, and from above, and all these tracks going in and out of these blocks, because it was all in silhouette. Mm-hmm. And that's been used so many times for, it all gets used for communication, paths of communication in industry. The route from manufacturer to customer through dealerships, you know, it just gets used and used and used. So if you can shoot conceptually, and you can think about how to illustrate a narrative or something that happens every day, those images will sell big in stock. If you go out and just shoot a scene or someone with a bit of a headache or something, you know, there's 1,000 pictures of that castle, or so, you know, there's 1,000 pictures of someone with their head in their hands. It's really important on the subject. Get the subject right and it will sell.
So it's, again, we come back to this concept of narrative. I mean, that's really what we're looking at.
Yeah. I think, you see, bear in mind that, I mean, my income now has gone principally from being paid per job, which was when I was at a wedding. You know, people pay you a certain amount of money to go and photograph their wedding and produce an album, to being paid in royalties. So now, the videos that I've produced, my book on the wedding photography, a book I did, a photograph with a model called Chloe Jasmine Wichelow, and this new book that I got coming out, an ebook, these will all be royalty incomes, and same with the photo library stock. And so all these things start to sell over a longer period of time. So, you know, you've got to start investing in things now, which will take a bit of time, maybe 5 years, perhaps even 10 years, to realize their full potential. I've done that, and that's allowed me now to be a bit more creative, go and travel the world and see different places, and it's opened up some opportunity. I think that's important for photographers as well. You've got to make sure you can see what's going to ahead of you. Mm-hmm. In a few years' time, what are you going to be doing? And are you going to enjoy what you're doing? Or what do you want to do? And then make that happen.
So where do you see the industry going then to look ahead?
I don't know. It's difficult, you see, because I started shooting. When I went from portraits, I decided I wanted to do something different rather than working with clients. I wanted to shoot what I wanted to shoot. And I started doing some workshops. People wanted a slice of the success that I'd had. And so we did workshops. And now I've stopped shooting workshops, doing workshops really. I mean, I still do a few, but now it's more adventures. So I'm going to come over to the States in May and have a 12-day tour through canyons and deserts and, you know, go on a road trip type adventure. And I'm moving now into travel and landscape photography. That's my sort of next move. It's going to take a couple of years to make that transition. But I've already started. I did a little tour and did a Venice trip earlier this year.
And then Cambodia, didn't you?
I went to Cambodia. I was talking with you about
maybe doing something in Southeast Asia or South Asia, and then I knew you were already heading out to Cambodia.
Yeah, so I went to Cambodia. But you see, the trips in Cambodia and even in Venice, you know, we're very much reliant on photographing people within the scene. I felt that that's that halfway step, really. You know? So that's my... I mean, I think the important thing is to keep changing, keep reinventing yourself. And for me, every 10 years or so, I've had a new career, you know, from a cameraman, lighting director, shooting news, being a commercial photographer, then a wedding photographer, then a portrait photographer, then someone who did workshops 3 days a week, training, now then a presenter making videos, and now a writer producing books and travel. So I think there's many, many facets, I think, to that journey of life and photography, right from 1984 when I was 19, right through to the present day, has been the core of the income stream. It's my imagery, and it's the way I shoot and the way I think and the way I visualize the scenes around me. That's been the core, but everything else has rotated around that. Mm-hmm. I think that's really the key. So I think if...
Wait, but before you head on there, let me interrupt. I just say, Would you say that that's probably going to have to be that way for every photographer? In other words, do you think that, like, I've done documentary and humanitarian work like that, and do you think it's time for, and I'm not asking specifically, I'm just using me as an example, though, but do you think it's, like, it would be time for me to push myself into something that I'm uncomfortable with, something new, something different, partly to keep the creative juices going and to always be challenged creatively, but partly also to maybe pad the future a little bit with other options and things like that?
Yeah, I think so. I think you mentioned comfort there, you know, something you're comfortable with moving on. I think you've got to move in. I think you've got to be uncomfortable with where you're moving in a way. Mm-hmm. I think you've got to stay out of your comfort zone. I think this is the problem. As soon as I get familiar, oh, I can shoot this. I've done this many times before. The pictures I shoot are boring. You know, they don't excite me. There's no real passion or vision there. I'm thinking, yeah, same old, you know, flash here, person standing there, wall there, you know, it's a form, becomes formulaic if you're really not careful. Mm-hmm. So you mustn't fall into that trap. But equally, you can must generate a style that's recognizable. So someone can say, hey, that's a Lovegrove shot, or that's a Matt Brandon shot. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to have a definable style and yet not have this sense of repetition. So I think that's really important. I think I encourage everybody, really, if you're wanting to have a career in photography, is to stay passionate, stay creative about what you do, and keep your mind open. When opportunity arises, take it. You know, I think an empty diary is a great asset. Once you've got your diary full of stuff, you don't become open to people's ideas. And I think, you know, if I said to you, we've had a chat before about India and Asia and things. Mm-hmm. And if I said to you, hey, Matt, I'm thinking of going to Iceland in 6 months' time, you know, for maybe 3 weeks. Do you want to join me on a little trip to Iceland? If your diary was full, you wouldn't have that opportunity to explore something like that. And as photographers, we need these key elements, maybe a trip. It might be a trip to the local park. I don't mind. You know, you need to pick the camera up and go to places where we've not photographed before, and react to the environment around us, to be put outside of our comfort zone, to really generate and create something that makes us tick. And I think that's really important. And if we get that vibe and the feel right, other people either want to join us, or if we are running workshops, or if we're out shooting for landscape and travel, they'll want to buy prints, you know, one or the other. They'll want the passion that's in that image to be part of their life in some way. Maybe a coffee table book, it might be a print on the wall, it might be the experience and the memory of joining us on a trip like that. So I think at some time you need to take the camera and move it out of the comfort zone and do something a bit different with it.
And the other thing I think that I think we miss this is that our experiences, the things that make us who we are, when we take that and we apply it to a different genre or a different place or a different type of photography, it informs that photography in a whole nother way that nobody else can see it that way. And in other words, in the last couple of years, I've been shooting the stills on Indian Summers, the Channel 4 big picture they're doing there. All right. Well, I've never done anything like that before. Never. I fell into the job strictly because I was actually trying to get a job as an extra for fun, just for grins, you know. And but when I brought my photography into this as a set photographer for them, I was taking images for them that they had not seen before. It was different than other people had shot because I was bringing it from a more of a journalistic standpoint, more of a documentary photography standpoint, rather than the people that had been in the industry shooting it over and over and over in the way that they've been doing it. And I think that's a little bit of what you're saying here. You know, we take our experiences, things that make us who we are photographically and otherwise, and when we go into a new area, we take that and we apply it and we create something different and unique that is ours.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think everybody, the customer, be it a corporate client or a big broadcaster, they are always looking for new. It might be a producer looking through scripts for films to shoot, and they're always looking for something that stops them. Mm-hmm. That's different. That's mm-hmm. new. And the power of new is really important. And that's the language of retail, you know. And it's important for a photographer to keep coming up with something different. It's like a band, you know. A band could have 10 tracks that they've put out on their first album. And they could just go touring around the pubs and clubs, putting out those 10 tracks. But you need more in the repertoire. They need to develop and explore. And the second album and the third album can be completely different. Mm. The body of work produced the first time around can be extrapolated and changed, and they can weave their own path. And I think as photographers, we need to do the same. It's really important not to try and keep recreating what we first had our first success with.
Right. But at the same time, you still have to be true to who you are. In other words, the Beatles' first album is completely different than the Beatles' last album.
Yeah.
But there's still a journey that you could able to follow and trace and say, McCartney and Lennon and all this, and you still feel it in there. You know.
Oh, totally. But of course, the influences from India and all these other things that, you know, that, as you say, it's the journey of life. You've got to pick those elements out of your life experiences and bring them into your photography. I really believe that. And so that's why I'm starting to go off and do a lot of travel, because the world is, it's big at the moment, but it's so accessible. So for me, I say big, I mean, it's because there's such a vast amount of it I've not seen. And there's only a finite amount of time in life. And I'm thinking, well, I don't want to do a 100th workshop in Bristol, doing the same old thing. But why don't I do that workshop in Vancouver or in Chicago or in Reykjavik or, somewhere? Mm-hmm. Because these are places that I'm going to walk down the street and feel inspired and feel excited. And then once I start bringing a core lighting strategy into these wonderful places, then the imagery is going to be exciting in the same way that when you were working with the Channel 4 productions in India, you were shooting stuff, which is, to them, was just really vibrant and new. And that's important.
Yeah, exactly. And let's talk about you. Let's talk about you going into someplace like Cambodia or Iceland, things like that. Are you still going to bring some of that thing that makes Damien Lovegrove, Damien Lovegrove? So I know that in Cambodia, you did model shoots while you were there. So it's not your typical travel type thing. You know, you're not just going to walk into Angkor Wat and take pictures of the temples and of street photography and things like that and walk away, because everybody and their brother's already doing that, and everybody's already been to Angkor Wat, or they've been to Varanasi, they've been to, you know,
but you know, they're shooting the same stuff.
Exactly.
You know, because they're shooting the same stuff, it makes it unexciting, uninteresting, because they're looking at where to put the tripod and what time of day do I need to be at Angkor Wat, and how low does the camera need to be, and where am I going to get the best reflection? And, you know, they get there and there's 20 other people there with tripods at the same time, same place. So why bother? You know, the picture already exists. There's no point reshooting what's already been done. So you need to go with a fresh set of eyes. And sometimes that's, you know, earlier last year, I went to Rome and I shot Rome without anybody in my pictures. So all the pictures I shot were void of people. And it was just the detail, the architecture, the cars, the spaces. And it was just a different way of looking at it. And it stopped people a little bit thinking, oh, wow, okay, I've not, you know, that's a very different way of seeing the world. Now, of course, you see, you think of me now as a photographer, who works with models, shoots portraits on location, etc. Now, you'd wind this conversation back 6 years, you would have thought, I hadn't shot a model in my life. You'd only know me as a wedding photographer who shoots everything at F4 and only shoots brides, only shoots on the day. I set shots up during the day, but I'm not a documentary wedding photographer at all. I know I want everything to look beautiful, perfect. So I'm getting there and make that happen. But equally, I was a wedding photographer, and I only started shooting models because I was running workshops and with real people. You know, obviously models are real people, but of course, people that are regular previous customers. If I want them to model for me, they often have their jobs. To take a day off work is so expensive. And also they get bored and they're impatient. Whereas if I work with a model, that I can turn my back to a model and talk to my delegates. And they're paid to be there in a way. I'm very respectful, of course. But of course, it's worth having a professional in there on the team, professional model on the team to deliver the workshops. And so I'm moving away from those workshops now. I stopped doing UK workshops last year. And now I just do work worldwide. But so my journey now is bringing what we call figure in the landscape. So I'm taking those models and putting them into the landscape. So the story and then the space around them is really that important. And then we'll go in perhaps 18 months' time, models perhaps won't exist in my repertoire of work, moving forward. I'm open-minded and see how the journey goes. But that's what my plan is at the moment.
What's on the horizon as far as your travel? In other words, you're talking about traveling. Where are you going? Are you going to be out in our neck of the woods in Malaysia?
Yeah, well, I'm going I go to Paris on Friday, and then I go to Antwerp the week after, do a job there. Then I'm going to explore some urban exploration locations in Belgium, castles and abandoned buildings and things like that. And we're going to go a little recce and shoot and have a bit of fun there. Then I'm off to America for a Wild West adventure, a road trip with 14 photographers in May, the last 2 weeks of May. And then I'm in Tuscany in September, and I might try and fit Croatia in before then. But it depends on the political situation. But there's a lot of trips coming up. Asia, I'd love to come back to Asia. I've recently done workshops in Singapore, in Jakarta, in Cambodia, as you know. I've been to Hong Kong, etc. Asia has still got a big pull for me. I do love the place, so I'm aiming to go back there. And Australia, because last time I did workshops in Australia, I missed out Adelaide, and I promised people in Adelaide I'd go back because they're like the fifth city, mm-hmm. I did Perth, Brisbane, Melbourne, Sydney, I am going to get around to that side of the world. But I was thinking I might want to do a little project. I had this idea for doing a book on Tango Argentino, and going down to Buenos Aires and other cities in Argentina and just sort of hooking up with the tango organizations there to photograph their sort of top 50 couples, the people that represent the current youth and vibrancy in the dance right now, and go and photograph them in their homes, speak to their parents, to maybe take a journalist with me and build the story. And maybe the left-hand page of the book will be the story of the couple, on the right-hand page, the pictures. And I'm thinking about hosing down the street at night and using continuous light and getting a local band to come and play and have everybody in the streets clapping and cheering and create that real vibe, that spirit and the visual excitement. Treat it like a scene from a film, but put the Lovegrove sort of style into that and work that through South America. I can imagine myself spending 6 to 8 weeks shooting a book on tango. So there's little projects like that I've got floating around in my head, and I'll try and make those happen.
Sounds exciting.
Sounds really exciting. Yeah, I mean, the trouble is, with all these things, you have to be able to take an idea and then turn that into reality. There's the difference, I suppose, between a dream and a good idea. And a good idea, of course, isn't a thought; it's an action in my mind.
Yeah, and that's. I think there's a lot of people that's going to be the bump right there. That's going to be the thing that keeps them from doing things, because they have great ideas. And I mean, I got to put myself in there as well. I've had great ideas, but then getting them executed sometimes is when these ideas die,
Yeah, it's because life gets in the way. People got to pay a mortgage, you've got children, you've got family. I mean, the only reason I can have this fantasy idea is because my daughter's about to go to university. We have no more commitments here at home. My mortgage is paid. I can think a little bit. We've got a shop, a Lovegrove shop, which sells lighting kit and equipment and videos and books and da-da-da. So that runs without me. Mm-hmm. And now I've got the opportunity in life, which is, I mean, I feel very privileged to have this opportunity, but to be able to go and do something, projects where I could sort of invest two or three months of my time to return a body of work, you know, that has value. Mm-hmm. And of course, I think we get used to it. When I left the BBC, I struggled initially because I didn't know how to run my life. You know, the BBC told me where to be, how much they were going to pay me, what my hours were, what my pension scheme is, and everything. I had to make no decisions from the age of 19, right the way through to sort of 30 or so. And so, you know, without having to make these decisions, when I left the BBC, I was completely lost. I had no concept of time management, how to run a business. You know, no one taught me how to run a business. I had to then suddenly realize and learn. I mean, we went very overdrawn, you know, really bad in financial position. But we got that back and we moved forward. But there's a lot of people who perhaps aren't prepared to take that risk. And I think it is a risk. You know, there's people say, oh, sure, you know, jack in work and go become a photographer. But there is a bit of a risk there. And you've got to be able to make that happen and get beyond that.
Well, I think that's where a lot of people that are hobbyists and they're talking about crossing over into making this their life's work. I think they only are thinking about photography. They think about the passion. They think about, oh, I'm very good at this. And they may be very good at this. But being a photographer isn't just taking pictures. You know, yeah. It's running the business. It's marketing. It's right. One of the most frustrating things for me is that most of the kind of stuff I shoot almost always needs to be paired with a paragraph or two paragraphs or a full story. And I can write, but it's like bleeding for me. I mean, it's not easy, yeah. You know? And so these are the kind of things that I don't think people are taking into consideration that, you know, do you have a work ethic? In other words, how much time are you going to be spend shooting? But then how much time do you realize you're going to have to spend on post-production? How much time are you going to spend on balancing the checkbook? Do you really need that gear? Because that gear is actually going to cost you money. And unless that gear is actually providing income, you don't need that gear.
Totally. This gear acquisition thing, you know, everyone talks about it. And I think we've lost the way in photography a little bit. I think and I blame digital in a way. I mean, mm-hmm. when I worked on film, I had a Hasselblad and some lenses. And once you got your camera and some lenses, that's it. You know, you just changed your film as each new emulsion came out. Oh, I must try that one, you know. But ultimately, the equipment lasted for years and it will still work now, mm-hmm. some 20 years later. But now people are thinking, oh, if I get that lens, I can get that type of shot. And if I get, it's tosh, you know, if you've got a lens that's round and it's creates sharp pictures, just go out and shoot, you know. In a way, you and I could probably do what we do with a couple of lenses and a camera. You know, that's it. You don't need to have all this stuff. And I have people come into my workshops and they bring in trolleys, you know, bags with wheels on. And in there, there's big lenses, F2 things. And, you know, they've got all this stuff. And then I'm thinking, it's a lifetime's work just mastering that kit. You know, I forget what it's like to use a lens, maybe the 60 millimeter. If I haven't picked it up for 3 months, it takes me a good couple of hours of shooting with it to really get to know it again. You know, it takes
to
get that buzz and that feel.
I hear you and I agree with you, but I almost feel like, and I don't mean this disrespectful because I'm right there with you, but I feel like in some ways we're part of that problem though, because we're,
yes, of course.
You know, because we're promoting like the X series cameras and we're, absolutely. We're showing out the new, you know, 51.4 telling how great it is and things like this. And people go, well, I have to get that. I need to get that.
Totally. I mean, I completely get it. But I think the point is that, you know, there's a difference and people must understand that, okay, as a working professional, I have a camera system. I only have one system at any time. In fact, I say system, it's probably even too big a word. You know, when I bought my Fuji X Pro 1 and the three lenses that came with it, I sold my Canon kit.
Yeah, so did I.
That's it. Yeah. So for a whole year, the only thing I shot with was the three lenses that came with the X-Pro1 and the X-Pro1. Yes, it was a challenge. It was a real challenge, but it liberated me. And then I've added other bits, and I've done work with Fuji, and then they said, oh, try this camera. Tell me what you think of it and try this camera. And I've been involved with things. So actually, I look at the shelf now, and I've actually probably got half a dozen X cameras, but I only can shoot with one at a time. So when I go out and shoot, I take one camera and a couple of lenses, you know? So, but of course, I got such variety of work from last week I shot a wedding dress collection. Yesterday I was doing a boudoir shoot in a local hotel. The day before I was in my studio doing a studio shoot. And, you know, the type of lenses that I use in the studio and the lenses I use in a boudoir are very different. You know, you might use fast primes for one project and then just a handy zoom, which works fine at F11 for another project. You know, so we have all this equipment, but actually the kit is there to be used, you know. Mm-hmm. So I will be having an eBay auction at some point soon, or charity auction, just because it's an obscene amount of equipment that's just amassed in my cupboards. I think, oh, God. Let's get rid of it. So, yeah, I mean, you're right. We're part of the problem. But equally, I think I want to put the message out to people, don't buy kit, you know, but just spend more time not worried about should I use this lens or should I use that lens, but just think about the emotion of the moment. Think about the walk into a space, feel it, see the light, get the buzz of the place is far more involved in a picture than what lens you have, or whether it's the Mark One or the Mark Two, and that really is irrelevant. You know, the pictures that I shoot, I was shooting on my X-Pro1, and the pictures I shoot on my X-Pro2, when you put them online on the blog, you couldn't tell the difference. But of course, if you make big prints, you need the 24 megapixel. If you don't make big prints, then the X-T1 is going to be fine for you. So although we talk about all this different kit, we don't say to people, hey, you have to have everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. Yes. No, that's fair. We definitely don't. You know, we don't do that. I mean, we're...
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're trying to inform people to say, look, hey, if you do have this lens, this is what it can do. Mm-hmm. If it's not, you know, if you don't shoot sport, you don't need that particular lens or whatever.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's interesting. I just finished I think you know this. I did a podcast with a buddy of mine, Pete Vandenay.
Yeah.
One of the things that came out in that was there are certain lenses that we didn't want to like, in a sense. You know?
I was there. I was listening to you thinking, oh, absolutely, it's the same, you know, because it didn't have OIS. Why make this lens without optical image stabilization? And then you go and use it and you think, oh, I love it, you know. But of course, as with all these things, you know, I was a portraitist, you know, when the X-Pro1 came out, I was in my portrait mode, you know. I was shooting workshops, yes, but I also had portrait customers, and there was the 60 millimeter lens, and it was a slow to focus, but it was super sharp, and I was thinking, oh, we could do something else. And now I look back and think, hold on a minute, we've got the 18-55, we've got the 56 millimeter, we've got the 50-140, we've got the 16-55, and then the 55-200 or something, and suddenly we've got six lenses at that focal length. We don't need them all, you know, it's just too much. Mm-hmm. So I would say to Fuji, you know, we've got a 35 millimeter F2, we've got a 35 millimeter F1.4, but it's an old one. Then there's this rumor of a 33 or something, you know. Just give us the 1.4 Mark II, you know, just make the 1.4, just bring it up to spec. And let's just keep with the system we've got, because my 35 is like 4.5 years old or something, and it's up for replacement.
Yeah.
But I could just, you know.
But that's an awesome lens. I mean, that 1.4, yeah. And that's why I'm sitting here looking at the F2 35, and I'm thinking, yeah. Okay, I like the form factor of it. It's really nice. It would work nice with the X-Pro2, and I like the fact that it's you know, sealed. But I like the 1.4. I like shooting at 1.4. And you're not going to get that.
I shot most of my shots yesterday with the 1.4. It's a little bit noisy, but it does the job and it works really well. I would just say that it'd be quite nice to have it weather sealed. That's all. Mm-hmm. And they've got, you know.
You just put a rubber band around it when you connect it.
Yeah, absolutely. Put it in a bag and just sort of put a filter on the front and cut the bit out. Do you remember we used
to
do that?
Yeah, you know, absolutely.
Back in the day, we put a camera in one of those Ziploc bags. Yeah. put a screw a filter onto the front, and then, you know, a filter ring, and then cut the bit of plastic around. That was your weatherproofing.
That's right. So,
but anyway, I think all of these things, I mean, we talk about equipment now. We've got this energy and buzz amongst with us. And suddenly we're back onto this gear acquisition syndrome, thinking, oh, what lenses do we want next? But, you know, we have all the tools in the toolbox that we could ever want or ever need. And there are times when you want to replace them or update them. But, hey, you know, I can't see the pictures becoming that much better now. You know, I think we're, what I mean is if you said to me, here's a brand new set of lenses, go out and shoot, I'm not sure that they would actually make any difference to the work that I produce. Okay, I might like to look at them or hold them or whatever, but that's not really what we're talking about. We're talking about the creative process of photography. And it's so easy to spend hours looking at Amazon or online at DP review or watching movies on reviews or looking at Fuji forums, and so you could spend 2 hours a night looking at all the stuff. And does it make you a better photographer? No. The important thing is to spend the time actually being creative, going out there, shooting. Every time you take a dog out, take a camera with you. Photograph close-ups on the fences, the detail, the water, the just anything. Just get to really get to know how the camera works. Photograph the sky, the land, you know, the clouds. And it doesn't matter when you come back, just format the card. Just go through that process of capturing images, learning the characteristic of the different film simulations. People say to me, should I use ProNeg S or should I use standard? What's the difference? Shoot it. Have a look. You know, compare the two, you know, bring them into the computer, look at them side by side, assign it in Lightroom, assign the two in Lightroom. Do they look the same? Does what's produced in camera look like it does in Lightroom? Get to understand that, because I think once you put that time and effort into the actual photography and the learning of how to shoot, then you'll find that your work is just leaps up and can become so much better. And I think that too much time is spent perhaps doing other things online. And it's great thing about a podcast is people can listen to this while they're driving to work or whether on the train or what have you. And so it's something that can, while you're editing your pictures, you can have it running beside you. And that's the great thing about a podcast. But I would say just get out there and shoot.
Yeah.
I shoot about 1,000 frames a week, every week. If I don't get 1,000 frames in or that sort of number, then I feel like I'm going backwards a little bit. You know what I mean?
Hmm. Yeah, I can't say I shoot 1,000 frames a week, but I definitely agree that one of the things that I keep telling people is, you know, people say, well, look at my images, look at what I'm shooting here. What do you think I need to do? And I look at it and I say, well, there's a lot that I could comment on this, but the thing that you need to do is go out and take more photos. You know, it's the old, how do I get to Carnegie Hall? Practice, practice, practice. You know, you learn by doing, and you can listen to podcasts, you can watch videos, you can get ideas, but unless you get out there and then put those ideas into practice, you've got to get out and start punching down that shutter button and seeing the results, you know, and that's the thing that I think that we have an advantage nowadays that we didn't. And I don't want to start this all over again, but the advantage of the digital era is that we get this instant feedback and you go, oh, so that's F2.
Yeah. Well, you get this feed forward now, you know, with the mirrorless system, with the Fuji. I mean, the big difference between an SLR, of course, and a mirrorless camera is that with a mirrorless camera, you get feed forward. You don't even have to press the button to see the shot. Mm. It's just presented there for you. It's the same when you're using a smartphone. You know, you're going to, whatever you might want to take a picture of, pint of beer at night or whatever it might be, your curry or what people do with smartphone. But the point is, you see the picture before you press the button, and when the picture looks good, you press the button. You know, that's simple. And of course, with an SLR, you take a picture, and then you have to press play and look back at what you've shot, and then you get to see what it's like. And that whole feedback loop has absolutely reduced the amount of time it takes to learn to become a reasonable photographer. And that's why the market for wannabe photographers shooting weddings or whatever it might be is saturated, because they've gone through that process of learning in maybe 6 months what it would have taken a film photographer several, you know, maybe 6 years to learn. But there's no shortcut for real experience. When it comes down to, yeah, there you are, you might be in India or something, there might be a bit of flood, there might be some issue going on, the light, it might be tipping the frame, but the light looks amazing, and you're going to go out there and you're going to shoot and capture this. You just have to know how your kit's going to react. Mm-hmm. You have to know. You're not going to be start thinking, now, do I shoot this at 1600 ISO, or what lens do I need to take? You just got to feel it. Mm-hmm. Get out there and do it. And that's where the problems come in for wannabe wedding photographers. It's all very well if everything goes well, but when it's dark and wet and the bride doesn't want to be outside and everyone's in the reception, they're all like this and they're hunched together because they've got to, they're all trying to stay dry in the library, and then they want group shots and there's nowhere organized and they haven't got any lighting with them. Of course, that's when it all falls apart. But hey, you know, we all had to go through those procedures, and we all had to go through the pain to get to the knowledge. And it's a fantastic journey. I mean, I think the biggest problem facing photographers now is that the concept of keeping the passion over a long period of time. You know, with all hobbies, whether it be golf or tennis or a sport, or whether it be driving or whether it be painting or whatever, it's so easy to give it up after 6 months or so and just stop doing something. And, you know, I see stories every day online about people selling their camera equipment because it's gathering dust, or, you know, they've just lost the passion or energy for it. And so what I will say to people is just make sure that you don't be too hard on yourself in the learning time. You know, when you are shooting, yes, your pictures might not be quite sharp, or you might have something growing out the back of someone's head or whatever. Learn from those experiences. Be proud of what you're doing, and just keep going. Don't take the knocks. Start to really push yourself and get through that sort of pain barrier to the point where everyone thinks, oh, I like that. Oh, I like that. Once you hit that point, it's so much easier to maintain the level curve, because I think a lot of photographers, a lot of creatives are very vulnerable people, you know, emotionally.
Very much so.
And I feel very vulnerable. You know, I come across as being a very confident photographer and stuff, but that's all a front, you know. Inside, you know, we're just always worried a little bit about the next job, and, you know, I'm thinking, oh, is this going to work? Is that going to work? And actually, when you get there, it's fine. But there's just that little bit of stage fright, I think, that still kicks in. And also, you do concern yourselves with how your image is, you know, in terms of how other people perceive you, you know, probably an unhealthy way. But as we said right at the beginning, you know, this whole concept of image is part of the retail process. It's all part of the branding that we now have to put on ourselves online. And it's very easy to be hurt emotionally, and so we have to protect ourselves to some extent. But once you get to the point where people are patting you on the back and they love your work, your pictures, then just ride the wave, because photography as a career is just the most wonderful thing you can do. It's just it's not like work. No, don't tell anyone, but it's not really work.
Okay, well, thank you. That's a good place to end. Damien, thank you for your time today. We've been having a blast talking about this. People want to find your work. They find it at
lovegrovephotography.com.
Okay,
that's my sort of personal website for portraits, etc. Don't be shocked at how cheap I am, how reasonably priced I am for a portrait shoot. The point is that you know, that's where I've got some galleries. There's about 2,000 or 3,000 pictures up there, which people can have a look through. Feel free use the pictures as for your inspiration. You know, drag them to your desktop. There's a little button on the pictures underneath each picture, actually says save, and it'll just save it in your downloads folder. So if you see something you like, the lighting, or maybe you like the pose, start to drag, you know. If you might be looking one night, you might spend some time thinking, okay, I want to find poses for people on a sofa or on a chair, and just go through the internet, start pulling out nice poses that work, and build up a folder in, I don't know, iPhoto or whatever, whatever app you use, of poses for sofas, or poses for standing in free space,
right,
or lighting for headshots, or whatever it might be. And just start gathering some inspiration, and then get a chair, get a bench, put it in the middle of your local scout hut or village hall or whatever it is. Just get a space for an hour, half an hour, and get a person, the neighbor, your daughter, your son, or your whatever, you know, someone, and just use that bench and just shoot. just recreate some of the poses, some of the ideas, identify what works, what doesn't work, and build up that repertoire. So you've actually got some great stuff. So lovegrovephotography.com will give you some good foundation pictures, which you can use for that sort of thing. Then there's Pro Photo Nut, which is my blog. And Pro Photo Nut, this is where I sort of chart my work that happens on a day-to-day basis. So about once a week or so, I post a blog on there. More recently, it's been X-Pro 2 stuff. And you'll see on there, actually, that a lot of the stuff that I publish is branded with Fuji stuff. So it says X-Pro 2 or shot on this particular lens. But understand that that really is there for SEO to some extent. Because, you know, if I put shot with a Fuji X-Pro 2, then we will get another 30,000 visitors. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, though, you know, I don't mind what camera you shoot with, whether you shoot Sony, Pentax, Nikon, whatever. It doesn't matter. The point is, be creative, be a photographer. Use what works for you. I'm not saying, hey, you've got to go out and buy this equipment, but that's what I'm using. So Pro Photo Nut. And then, of course, you can find me on social media, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, etc. So, but it's been lovely to be here with you, Matt, and having this chat conversation. And you know, I'm sure the conversation will carry on in comments, and we'll have to get together again soon. And maybe we can do a trip.
I'd love to do that. It'd be a blast. Yeah, it'd be really fun. All right, Damien, thanks so much. And we'll catch you out on the internet.
Matt, take care, my friend. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening. You know, I don't take it for granted that you take an hour out of your day to listen to this podcast. I really appreciate it. Now listen, be sure to drop by thedigitaltrekker.com. Check out my blog there. Recently, there's a post about off-camera lighting and a review of a new softbox that is really changing the way we set up and tear down softbox. I mean, it is done in seconds. Seriously, seconds. Check it out at thedigitaltrekker.com. While you're there, check out old episodes of Depth of Field that you may have missed. I've spoken with photographers of the likes of Michael Freeman, Nevada Ware, adventure photographer Dan Carr, Nat Geo photographer Amy Vitale, and so many more. Check out all those old episodes. They're all waiting for you. If you get a chance, better yet, let me ask you to take the time and go by iTunes and rate us, or even leave a short or long comment. Whatever the iTunes voodoo is, by rating us, it helps us get the show in front of more listeners. And if you enjoy this podcast, share it. Share it on Facebook, on Twitter, or whatever social media you use. Let people know about this podcast, okay? Lastly, be sure to check out the On-Field Media Project, ofmp.org. It's a nonprofit that I started a few years back, and it helps other nonprofits learn to tell their own story without having to outsource it to media experts. And while you're there, if you feel led to contribute something to the work, well, we wouldn't complain. Thanks again for listening. I'm Matt Brandon, and this is Depth of Field.